Clinical Problem Solvers. Our new book will be out in a few weeks. It is going to be epic, and we think you're going to love it.
Is it Reza loves Robbie, or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome, you will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers.
There's three Clinical Problem Solvers right now, Prof. Three of them.
Do you know why I was so energetic? How can I not be energetic when I'm seeing the beautiful, intelligent, and incredible Zabit?
Don't stop, Reza. Keep going.
No, Robbie, I've known Zabit. Zabit, has it been probably a decade almost?
Yeah.
I feel like early and
crazy.
I just always have been so impressed by you, my friend, and not only about your intellect, but how kind you are and how caring you are. The one person who always checks in on me, Robbie, is Zabit. I'm not even joking, and I'll never forget that. It's actually caused me to check in on other people because I'm like, man, Zabit, who I don't see like every week, checks in on me. I'm going to check in on other people because I know how much it means. So thank you for that, Zabit.
How did you guys first meet? I don't know the story.
So we were at this club, and the dance floor, I see this handsome, handsome stud that I approached.
What was it? Was it maybe a online conference? First through like Human DX, and then and then SHM 2016-ish?
Yes.
We're so few and far between people who are like as far along in Zabit's career who's still obsessed with diagnosis and clinical raising. It's really a really cool thing and a real gem.
Obsessed with you guys and really excited to crash it.
Yeah, you know, we folks who are listening to this, we put out a call to like, hey, let's get to know our audience and bring all our CP Solvers folks who we haven't gotten to know. And I think so far we're basically like recruiting from our very own just to get to spend more time with Maddie. And today, in equal regard, we get to spend more time with Zafin. So welcome. This is your house as much as it is ours. And I think for folks who are listening, we're all literally signed in with the Clinical Problem Solvers Zoom account to illustrate
And when he says it's your house, he literally means that. Like, I've been to Robbie's house so many times. I'm not even joking, Zabit. There's nothing that's off limits in his house in terms of, you know, food and comfort. I shouldn't say everything, but almost everything is accessible. I don't know where my mind is going.
We should get to the case.
Yeah, let's get to the case.
Let's do it. Next time you go to Robbie's house, you got to trim those plants or they're going to eat him.
That's the story that I will say for another time. It'll take 10 minutes, but yeah.
Okay. I want to be really careful to share the right. I just have like some of the aliquots, some visuals for you guys for the heavier.
Oh, nice. RLR's yes.
RLR's yes. All right, shall we?
Take it away.
So this is a case from the fall here in Texas. And the context is that it's actually your close friend who reaches out to you for some advice about his kid who's not feeling well. And this story will sort of evolve over some days. It'll be about 8 aliquots, but some of them are quick before the diagnosis is known. So here's the first aliquot. He calls you. He says his son, who's 19 years old, healthy guy, goes to college in town. He woke up one morning, and when he tried to get up, he felt this really sharp, severe pain in his left hip. So bad that he like kind of let out a scream and fell back in his bed and had to like catch his breath. We'll pause there.
Yeah, I think, you know, Zabit, I think we're struck by the focality of the symptom complex. And I think in general, whenever a patient is directing you to a specific part of their body, you know that the overwhelming probability that there's a focal structure involved is extremely high. And yeah, I know I continue to pontificate on this topic in RLRCP solvers, where essentially trying to break down all the medicine into either the effect of a substance or the manifestation of a specific structural problem. And when there's such profound focality, the question becomes what structure is involved. And the only advice that I have to share on the localization here is to not be definitive with the word hip. When people use the word hip, they use it colloquially, and it can mean anything in the groin area. So for me, what I'm really, really interested in is to figure out exactly what structure this pain is coming from. And then after we do localize the structure, then there's a whole differential diagnosis based on where it's coming from. I think what I'm really, really struck with is the acuity in the time course. And I honestly would love to pass the mic to Prof. Rez to see what he's making of that.
Gosh, when he said he has a kit to present, I got really nervous. I'm like, man, Zalman doesn't know how poorly I did on my Pete's rotation.
But Reza, we're at least I'm that old now. We're like friends' kids are 90 years old. So that's how you got. That's your saving grace. Is our geriatric status?
It's so true. I think that I'm viewing this as someone presumably healthy until Zalman shares more information. And the sudden onset often to me means that something has been obstructed, ruptured, of that nature. So it's quite odd. And already Zalman, like I'm framing this as an atraumatic hip pain. But as Robbie said, we have to understand the lay of the land to see exactly where this patient is experiencing discomfort and be open to the possibility that this can be referred. But the acuity, the hyperacuity just makes me worried that something rupture or get obstructed.
Cool. Okay. So here's a little bit more of the story. The pain is in the anterior part of the body, in sort of the groin anterior hip area. And again, he sort of felt this horrible pain and then like fell back in bed, like waited it out for a minute, I guess. And it did sort of settle down to a milder ache. But then when he tried to move again, same thing. Eventually he was able to, kind of get up, go sort of, you know, wash up and hobble to his first class. And he took some ibuprofen on the way, but was sort of surprised at what this was. This really seemed to kind of come out of nowhere. He hadn't had any trauma, injury, hadn't fallen, hadn't even like played sports the last few days. Never happened before. And then later that day, basically trying to like get up from sitting down in class, same thing. Like it was bearable, but then that first movement was really bad. And then once he'd start moving, it would actually like, it would still hurt, but it sounded like it was better. And he was able to like, you know, kind of limp around a little bit. That was the rest of the day basically. And, we can be quick here. I don't know if there's sort of too much more to say, but, any comment on that sort of, feature of really bad first movement and then seems to like be a little more tolerable?
Yeah, I think that using analogical reasoning, we often think of osteoarthritis, ouch with activity, it worsens with activity, while inflammatory joint problems like rheumatoid arthritis, you get relief with activity. In fact, my mom has knee pain right now. When she sits down, she feels fine. When she stands up, is when it feels the stiffest and then it gets better with movement. So the only thing I can think of here is that it doesn't sound yet like this is an articular process, but if it were, it would be inflammatory in nature, given that it improves with movement. But the reason and you have to realize too, with the hip, it's such a deep joint that even if you examine this patient, and remember audience, Zalman is trying to navigate this through a telephone. Who even know, like he might not even be looking at the patient's hip. We'll get more detailed, you know, in a short time. But the hip is a deep-seated joint. So even visibly, it might look fine. But when you move it, you know, and examine the patient, you might elicit discomfort, which points to a deeper structural problem. But the other thing I thought about sudden onset in a young guy is, could this be testicular torsion? Could this patient have something happening that's outside of the hip area that's referring pain there. But I don't know how that would necessarily improve with movement. Robbie, anything else to layer on before we get more data?
Yeah, no, Professor, I'm just, I'll do the opposite of what I asked you to do, is just continue to study the time course. Because I think, you know, honestly, if you just sit for a moment and draw the line that this patient is painting for us, he has apoplectic onset disease. And what's happened to his line is it seemed to have mellowed out a little bit, right? Because I think we'd expected him, based on the acuity of how quickly it happened, to not be able to make it to class and have to go to the ER, right? So the line is bending a little bit. And I think it can bend for two reasons. The first is that the disease process slows down a little bit. So somebody has something that's apoplectic in onset, but then starts to mellow out. Or that he actually is having this in an organ with a tremendous amount of reserve that can hold on to a disease for a period of time. So if you're comparing and contrasting, of course it's not relevant here, but if he has such severe pain from an aortic dissection, it's not going to mellow out like this, right? Because the reserve in the aorta is much, much, much less. But if you have an intra-articular hemorrhage, for example, say he has undiagnosed hemophilia, he bleeds into his joint, the hip capsule, the bleeding can happen, but the hip capsule can tolerate it for a day or two before it gets worse and worse. So I think acknowledging that he is now less sick than I thought he was going to be based on how abrupt it was. And the question to try to answer, is it because the disease has slowed down a little bit, or is it because the organ in which it's developing has a little bit more capacity for a short period of time? I'm really curious to see how that, which of those two will be more likely in him.
Great. Okay. The next aliquot is very short, and it's the fact that that night, he has a fever to 101.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that this is coming back full circle to me, Professor, because now that tension of substance versus structure is very, very interesting, because now the patient definitely has features of both. He has a focal structural issue for sure, and now he has a substance, i.e. a cytokine, inducing a fever. And so the question really becomes, how are these two things related? And I think the simplest hypothesis would be that he has an inflammatory process in his inguinal region that is resulting in a fever. But I think now that you have a fever, you have to emphasize the reality that the possibility that there's a multifocal process causing this fever becomes real. So in other words, it's very, very unusual for a tiny geographic area to unleash a systemic response. And so now I would slow down and say, okay, this has gotten way more serious. You have a microscopic area causing a high inflammatory response. Let me make sure that this is just not the tip of the iceberg and there's something more visceral and deep going on. There are exceptions to this, of course, with upper respiratory tract infections and viruses like COVID and flu being the most common one. But to just give you an example, it would be pretty unusual to have focal cystitis cause a fever of 101. It's much more likely that the process is deep, like pyelonephritis. So I think now I'm pretty worried about the idea of multifocality in this patient, and would really try to make sure that we scrutinize head to toe to see where else the disease might be.
Amazing. Okay. So let me expand on what happens the next couple of days. So first of all, regarding the focality, doesn't seem to be any other symptoms. It was just this, you know, hip pain and this fever. And the fever kind of continues for a couple of days. But the hip pain actually lasts another day and a half. And then you get a text saying that the pain's gone. Like, it's better. It just sort of went away. He was taking like ibuprofen a few times a day. But other than that, you know, there wasn't any treatment or anything. It just kind of like petered out. But the fevers actually, you get another call the next day that they keep going, and they're actually like really high and really bothersome every night, 102, 103, 104. He sort of loads up on acetaminophen, ibuprofen, and eventually it kind of breaks, and then he just sleeps all night, kind of later into the morning than usual. But no other symptoms anywhere else. So no new information here other than the fact of this hip pain that was so severe and prominent, and the only localizing symptom kind of goes away after 2 days or so while the fevers continue.
Yeah, I think, Zalman, this is really helpful because now we can say the patient's inflamed. And I think once this case completely, you know, you tell us what happens, maybe this hip pain and its acute onset is going to be related to the fever. At time point zero, all our attention would be to the joint and making sure the patient doesn't have a septic joint. But now that the pain has completely resolved, that is inconsistent with the possibility that you have an intra-articular infection. So now we have fever with no localizing symptom and probably no localizing sign. And it's persisted for a couple of days. And so I think the question that the patient's father would ask, he was like, does he need to go to the emergency department? Is there something sinister that is brewing beneath? And he's a young guy. And I think if there is, I would actually be more worried about a fever without a localizing symptom than a fever with a localizing symptom. Because if you told me this kid is having upper respiratory symptoms or is having diarrhea, I'd be like, that's okay. Like, it's going to hopefully resolve and you can monitor. But when you say hip pain, that's gone away. And now fever, but otherwise feels fine. That makes me worried. And actually, honestly, it would prompt me to ask more about the social histories, particularly what kind of activities does he do? Is he outdoors? Is he sexually active? And if someone had fever for a number of days without an answer and is young, and like Robbie alluded to this, this patient probably has so much cardiovascular reserve being 19 years old and healthy. I'm very, very curious to see what his CBC shows, what his liver chemistry test shows, specifically with an attention to the AST, ALT, and the platelet, and then just getting a little more in terms of his social history, because we have inflammation without symptom, though the hip may ultimately give us a sense of what this answer is. And that just makes me want to look internal. Is there anything else I can use as a clue to what might be driving this non-specific inflammation? I would love to see what Robbie has to add. I just am more worried about this guy than I would be with someone who has a viral syndrome.
I've never seen her. I can't imagine what it's like to be getting texts like this about somebody that is, you know, this is like the weirdest story under the sun. I don't think I've ever heard a narrative like this where there's these sequence of events. And so, Professor, I have nothing to add because I think your reflection about the fever is superb. So I was just latching on to what you're saying and then processing how the hip pain managed to go away. And I'm just applying simple rules of thumb, which is that as I've said to you before, I think many infections go away if we just let them be and take the natural history, but certainly this is not happening. As a general rule of thumb, diseases that are closer to the outside of the body have a much higher chance of spontaneous resolution than diseases on the inside. And I think this is an intuitive fact, right? Like, it's much easier to heal cellulitis spontaneously than it is to heal endocarditis. And so I'm using that to start to generate some hypotheses about what the heck this hip pain might have been. And I'm starting to wonder if it was an underappreciated skin disease. And starting to wonder, wait, did he have a bite or a source of portal of entry? Because you are invoking the idea there's something in his blood because you want the CBC and the AST and ALT. And I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, that's a brilliant thought. Where do those things come from? They come from a prick on the skin. So I'm starting to wonder, like, could he have had something, a flea, a tick, something bite him and he just didn't realize it? And it reminded me of Prof. Rez. Remember when Nar had that massive tick in his eye and how, like, it was horrible for a few hours and then it went away, like completely went away. So yeah, I'm intrigued by this story. And I think I would just honestly, like, the patient has no hip pain now. So let's solve the fever. And your approach to that will be superb, but it'll be really interesting to back calc and see what was the thing at the hip. And I'm wondering if it was something at the surface, because I have a hard time imagining that torsion, septic arthritis has the ability to spontaneously fix itself. There are, of course, diseases that can do that, like crystalline diseases I'm thinking of. But I'm very, very intrigued by the sequence of events. It's certainly something I've never encountered or read about before.
Yeah, it's a weird case, and it's going to get maybe a little weirder.
Okay,
you know, I think the crystalline hypothesis is great too, because the the anti-inflammatories could have been the treatment for that, right? Like, but the persistence of the systemic inflammation, which can happen during the arthritis, like that's what doesn't fit. I'm gonna pause on this case for a second. I know how much you guys love doing like a case within a case. So I'm not gonna present another like unknown. I'm just gonna tell you guys about just a parallel case with some similarities and differences very briefly that is very interesting. But maybe about a year ago, Simon, older kid, wakes up, and he was five then, wakes up and Steph and I are in bed. But I hear his movement in the hallway, and usually he stomps and romps and runs, right? So it's usually like, and then like he comes into our room and is like, good morning, whatever. But this time the sound of his movement is different. And I hear this like slight little thudding and then pulling, like friction. And already like something's off. And indeed he like crawls into our room, and he says the words, "Bob, I can't walk so good anymore."
Oh.
And like my heart rate just like you know jumped up, and I was like, "Oh, Simo, come on up." He got in bed, and I was like, "What's hurting?" And his hip was hurting. And I, you know, just sort of like kind of did like a little internal rotation, sort of rotation of the femur and the hip joint. And indeed, like that was the painful thing. And he wasn't letting me do that. And like he had femoral joint, like synovitis. Like it was, and I was like, oh no, you know, like it just immediately got a little worried. But like he's otherwise well, like he wasn't hot, he wasn't anything, and he had been sick the last few days, but just like, you know, another cold, right? So I very quickly, but like some things, like very old memories are binging in my brain, and I like quickly Google stuff and realize that this is an extremely classic presentation of transient synovitis that happens in like 3, 4, 5, 6 year old after a viral illness. It's just like an inflammatory synovitis, most commonly of the hip, usually just unilateral, just sort of onset very much like this. So he basically just took ibuprofen for a couple of days and it completely went away. And I talked to some pediatrician friends, like same, you know, very quickly told me extremely classic. They're like the median age or the modal age is exactly 5 years old. But the difference with this case, we're going to go back to this 19-year-old again, is that, again, Simon was never febrile, and it was sort of a purely joint disease with that, and it was sort of a post-infectious inflammatory thing and not without these, like, high persistent fevers. So, okay, we can go back to the case, but any comments, reflections?
My only comment is I'm about to lose my job to use Zalbin. That is so good. You bringing out to another case, then bringing it back to this case. I feel like I have two Robbies that I'm contending with right now.
I've learned from the best, you guys. I know I love those multiple cases that y'all do. So no, I just wanted to bring that in because yeah, and also with your pediatrics fear, right? Like I had last heard of that like 15 years ago, you know, on my like peds rotation, and it was an amazing comeback. But yeah, he did really well and just limped for like 2 days, and he was back to his happy self. Okay, Aliquot 5, 19-year-old guy with acute hip pain. Oh, I also just wanted to, that case reminded me to say, like, this sounded like it was like an inside hip joint problem. It was like when he would move his actual femur that would hurt, like on the outside, there were no rashes, no swelling, no pain, no tenderness from the outside. This pain, like it would be whenever he would like, you know, twist his leg or like bend his hip or, yeah. Okay, what happens next? He does go to the campus clinic, on his college campus, and you hear that apparently like his vital signs were normal there, and he just sort of like looked okay, just tired. The doctor there sort of like examined his hip, but mostly it was fine, like maybe a little sore with like extremes of range of motion, but like nothing like the pain that, you know, he had experienced initially. He got checked for with a respiratory viral panel that was negative. He got a monospot that was negative. It's not clear right now whether he got checked for STIs, but they didn't like prescribe him anything. And, you know, it's a college campus, so we had just sort of like assumed he probably, there was no signal there. And then other sort of social stuff, y'all were wondering, he drinks occasionally on campus and at home, but like doesn't do any drugs. Hasn't had any like unusual exposures, no like animals or bites or really outdoor time. And his only travel recently was to Greece. 2 months ago, he sort of traveled with family, came back. He has family there, but not more recently than that. So how does that exclusion or non-exclusion of stuff y'all were thinking move the needle at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's only a snapshot in time, but if you just take what you're seeing in front of you, you're seeing a normal vitals, a normal physical exam, and normal initial superficial data, right? Like a respiratory viral panel. So I think that I'm noticing the disconnect between what the ears are saying when you listen to him describe the story and what your eyes are seeing. And your eyes are seeing something that you are very happy to see, a healthy person with normal vital signs and a normal exam. And your ears are going, no, 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 there's something serious going on. And in general, definitely not in this case, but in general, trained eyes supersede the ears, right? The ears are often a piece of data that comes from an untrained person versus the eyes are, especially if they're prof-res's hazy eyes, they see through everything. So I know for a fact that you're bringing this case to extract deeper lessons, but I would be remiss to say that when that's happening in my life, the patient's often going to be fine. So that's where I take that piece of data, whopping dose of reassurance, but maybe Prof Rez has some more advanced nuances.
No, I have no advanced nuances.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, I think that sounds right to me too, except that he keeps having the fevers every night, 103, 104. A couple of days later, he goes to a PCP, gets some blood work. You have your CBC Reza. White count is 10. Normal differential. Maybe it was a little neutrophil skewed, but nothing was lighting up. He was anemic. Hemoglobin was 11. His platelets are normal. All his chemistries and LFTs normal. UA normal. He gets a set of blood cultures drawn, and those are pending for now, but that's all the blood work they did. But in the meantime, these next kind of few days, sort of day, I guess, I don't know, maybe it was 5 to 10 from initial symptom onset, he develops some more symptoms. He develops multiple painful oral ulcers. He notices these red purple bumps on the back of his knuckles on both hands. They don't bother him. They're like, don't hurt. They're kind of flat, like rubbery, but just like it's there. He sees them. No skin lesions anywhere else. His dad says that just on the phone, he sounds like just very uncharacteristically like moody and irritable. And then the last 2 days, his right knee started hurting. Again, like very prominent, painful, barely walking with a limp kind of thing. Looked a little swollen and was warm, apparently. But again, without any sort of preceding trauma or injury. No other joints other than this knee. He's got a little headache with the fevers, but nothing sort of very prominent or persistent. And then still no chest, respiratory, urinary, eye or GI symptoms, other than just like not being able to eat well because of how painful the oral ulcers are.
Wow. The medicine is interesting, but I'm just putting myself in the position of this young kid's father and like how scared they must be, because I feel like there's three scenarios in medicine. You find an answer and you can do something about it, the best case. You find an answer, you can't do something about it, still okay, because you can understand what to expect. The worst case, where this kid is in right now, you don't have an answer and there's nothing you can do about it yet. This is dread. But as you were speaking, I'm going to definitely need Robbie's help, because I don't think anyone recognizes patterns better than him. As you said,
as you said, oral ulcers, and then you said skin findings, my mind automatically converted that to a mucocutaneous illness. Then you said the joint is swollen, and I was like, okay, mucocutaneous and monoarticular arthritis. And then you said some mood and irritability. Now, we use the word encephalopathy quite broadly, but now I'm wondering, do we have a multi-systemic disease showcasing itself, manifesting on the skin, the mucus, the joint, and the CNS? But there's one more very important element. And what I'm trying to do deliberately here is create the problem representation. Robbie and I, Zovin, and I am sure you're on this camp, we put more emphasis on identifying the correct problem than ever before, because a lot of people will just, they'll see the sodium and then they'll go into treatment. But no, like, you got to first make sure you're solving the right problem. So for me, this is a subacute, progressive, inflammatory syndrome that's involving the mucus, the skin, a single joint, and the brain in a young patient with no medical history. And now I'm wondering if that hip was actually, he did have some kind of joint problem, but now it's sort of a migratory oligoarthritis. Now I'm saying all these buzzwords, I'm saying it slowly for something to trigger in Robbie's brain, but I would honestly, of all these findings, I would start with the ulcers. They sound like aphthous ulcers, but there's several, and they're not isolated. Like, all of us have experienced, or I think many of us have experienced an aphthous ulcer, but it doesn't come with bumps on the skin, with high fevers, with joint pain. So then I went through my quick schema for, like, what can cause an oral ulcer, especially in a young patient. And immediately I thought, could this be an STI? And remember, the thing with STIs is that the classic one we associate with ulcers is HSV. People will tell you, oh, syphilis chancre doesn't cause ulcer or doesn't cause pain. But the reality is many of these STIs can coexist. So for example, could this patient have herpes simplex virus with gonococcal arthritis and maybe gonococcal rash? It's a stretch, but it's important to consider once you mention ulcers. The other big category to think about when you think about ulcers in the landscape of multisystemic disease is autoimmune conditions. Immediately, my mind went to inflammatory bowel disease. And remember, with inflammatory bowel disease, you do not need gastrointestinal symptoms. This would be odd, but there are extraintestinal manifestation, and it can absolutely involve the joint, involve the skin, and cause ulcers, particularly Crohn's, anywhere in the gastrointestinal tract. This prompted me to think about other autoinflammatory syndromes. And autoinflammatory syndromes are different than autoimmune. In autoimmune, you're responding to a specific antigen, and a prototypical example is lupus, where there's immune dysregulation to self leading to this complex clinical syndrome. And autoinflammatory, it's actually the innate immune system. There is no antigen. And a prototypical example of an autoinflammatory disease is adult onset Still's. Nothing about this sounds like adult onset Still's, but that whole family, you can just start naming like papulo, aphthous, this, that, and end up with a acronym that defines one of the autoinflammatory syndromes. So for me, my focus right now is the ulcers, the joint, the skin. And I'm like, is there some kind of disseminated infection? It's subacute, it's progressive, but it waxes and wanes. Or is this in reality some kind of autoinflammatory syndrome that has a acronym that I'm just not familiar with? And does this patient need infectious rule out? And it seems like they had some mild anemia, which is probably the underlying inflammation. And then do they need something like anakinra, or the fact that they improve with ibuprofen? Because some of these diseases, autoinflammatory, like FMF, familial Mediterranean fever, though that classically presents with abdominal pain, is quite sensitive to things like colchicine. That's a diagnostic test. So I will pass the mic to Robbie, because again, I think he does so great with the pattern recognition. But at this juncture, I'm really worried about an auto-inflammatory disease or an autoimmune disease, given his age, or a disseminated STI based on the problem representation that I've synthesized with you guys today.
Yeah, Professor, all the thoughts that you're sharing are the ones that I'm exactly sharing. And the reason that they're stuck in my mind is I see a massive disconnect between the height of the fever and where the problems are. And I think as a general rule of thumb, especially in adult medicine, when we talk about geriatric medicine, when you see a fever 103, you expect the CT scan, not the physical exam, to tell you the source of that fever at 103. What I mean by that is a really bad pneumonia, cholecystitis, pyelonephritis, so on and so forth. And yet here, the physical exam and not the CT scan is telling us where this fever of 103 is coming from. And I think if you just think about autoimmune diseases in general, they are diseases of the extremities, arthritis, skin disease, and then only in advanced severe phases do they go into the viscera affecting the lungs in terms of ILD, the kidneys in terms of nephritis. And so this is a classic setup for autoimmunity, where a patient has an extremity-focused disease with high fever, but there's a two big red flags. The first is the abrupt onset. Autoimmune diseases don't begin like a thunderstrike, literally. There are some very, rare exceptions, like Kawasaki's disease, for example, begins abruptly. IgA vasculitis can begin abruptly. But you definitely have to acknowledge that even though this lay of the land is looking autoimmunity, the tempo of the disease is unusual. But there's another, I think, bigger dagger in the autoimmune category hypothesis, which is the label that you so aptly applied, which is migratory arthritis. So I learned this recently because I lurk, my wife is a rheumatology fellow, and I lurk on the rheumatology case conferences. And, you have to be very strict about what migratory arthritis means, because many people get additional arthritis, right? Like your wrists start to hurt in RA, for example, then your MCPs hurt. So that's cumulative arthritis. Migratory is literally when it vanishes and moves somewhere else. It is literally transplanted into another part of the body. And this patient has classic migratory arthritis where the hip is gone and the knee starts. And as a general rule of thumb, migratory arthritis is a big no-no for autoimmunity. It's very, very unusual for autoimmune disease to present with migratory arthritis. And there's two exceptions, and you've hit on those exceptions. It's the family of spondyloarthropathies with reactive arthritis, IBD-related arthritis being the two best examples of where the disease can be very fast, and then rarely in lupus. The focus, and rheumatologists will tell you this, the focus of migratory arthritis is infection, 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 infection. The idea being that you have, and it's not just any kind of infection, it's a very unique subset of infections. Staph aureus septic arthritis will never cause migratory arthritis. The reason for that is that the hip will never heal with Staph aureus. It'll just get worse and worse and worse. So there are a subset of infections that give the body a chance to fight back and win. And they're gentle infections. And the vast, vast, vast majority of them are either viral or sexually transmitted infections. The one really important exception, especially in a young person, is rheumatic fever. So rheumatic fever will classically present with migratory arthritis, with a lot of pain, and unfortunately have some cardiac consequences. So for me, I'm right there with you worrying about autoimmunity as a potential evolution. But I think the list of infections that I would really worry about are all the viral ones that we know cause oral ulcers, including Coxsackie, HI. Like basically, there's no educational value in enumerating all of them. Just look them up and send every single one of them. But I would be particularly looking for strep, given the cardiac consequences. Worried about rheumatic fever, and would ask about 2 or 3 weeks ago a strep throat-like syndrome, if that was there in the history. And then I would be sending gonorrhea, chlamydia, HIV, and syphilis. Same arc as yours. And now the hip pain is fascinating to me because I never thought to think of migratory arthritis, but I think that's probably what's going on in him. Yeah. Any other thoughts you want to sprinkle on, Prof?
That was an amazing discussion, both you guys and Reza. That stating the problem and like saying migratory oligoarthritis, like you did, you will see is the key to this case. And Robbie, those are amazing pearls from Kara's room conference. I'm gonna keep those. he does end up seeing rheumatology and infectious diseases in clinic over the next couple of days. The initial blood cultures, by the way, are negative. You know, ID had sort of like thought about doing an arthrocentesis, but by the time he sees them, the knee is all better. They check him for EBV, CMV, HIV, all negative. His ANA and rheumatoid factor are negative. He gets a chest x-ray, which is clear, and an abdominal CT that shows prominent inguinal retroperitoneal lymph nodes bilaterally and an 18-centimeter spleen. ID orders a TTE that's negative. In the meantime, his fevers are continuing. His elbow swells up next. It's red, hot. And over this time course, he's lost about 10 to 15 pounds. They draw another set of blood cultures and they check him for some other infections, but don't know which ones yet. And they also refer him to heme. And in the meantime, the other sort of piece of history that comes out, speaking, Robbie, to your point of sort of the explosive onset, it turns out that the couple of weeks before this, he woke up with this hip pain. He was sweating a lot at night. And like having to change a shirt in the morning, change sheets. But he didn't think that was a symptom. Apparently he thought it was just like too hot, and he like got a different comforter and stuff like that. Because at that time he wasn't feeling sick. He would just like wake up and he would be, you know, damp to soaked. But that was going on a couple of weeks.
Well, Prof. I think now that the problem representation changes dramatically, I think the biggest reflection for me goes to show you the value in an undifferentiated patient of just looking in the belly. We were having this conversation earlier about like how attendings change management on teaching services. I feel like the only time I actually change management is when I recommend a CT abdomen pelvis to the team, because often there's a little bit of reluctance in getting it, and gosh, the things we found. And I think it's jaw-dropping to think of how this problem changes. So
I just make a quick interjection for old time's sake? I told my team to get a CT chest abdomen pelvis in a patient the other day. Yeah. And this has never happened. The radiologist called after they read it to be like, why did you order this study? Because it was that normal.
That's so funny. Yeah, that happens too, Prof. Yeah, I'd love to pass the mic to you to see how this changes. I think for me, the biggest thing I'm stuck with is if you really, in order to solve a problem, you need to inventory every organ, especially when a problem looks elusive like this. And so I'm glad we inventoried the belly. It's changing things dramatically. Yeah, mic to you, my friend.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I think it's so interesting because when you said nightly fevers, you know, they use terms like quotidien, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, or Pell-Epstein's fever, where they come and go. And I was like, could this young guy have lymphoma? And then you're telling us he have night sweats. And so what I'm going to update the problem representation with, in addition to migratory oligoarthritis, which I think later when I read about it, and will add so much value in future discussions, but unfortunately right now I don't have a great schema for it, is lymphadenopathy, splenomegaly, so something happening in the reticuloendothelial system. And when you have this, it's not isolated lymphadenopathy, right, Robbie? This is diffuse, and it's involving the retroperitoneum. So when you're approaching lymphadenopathy, and quite frankly, that's where I would anchor my thinking in, is both the enlarged spleen and the lymph nodes. And then when I list diagnoses, I would see if they could explain the migratory oligoarthritis, the aphthous ulcers that this patient's experiencing, and the cutaneous findings that they're also experiencing. At the end of the day, when you have diffuse lymphadenopathy, the first question is, can you get to a diagnosis without requiring a biopsy? And there's a few instances you can, and they've already sent a monospot. The lack of LFT abnormalities, the lack of atypical lymphocytosis really lessens the likelihood of those diseases of infectious mononucleosis, which includes HIV, EBV, CMV, toxo. But then, additionally, you worry about autoimmune that Robbie said. I know we're not too concerned, but the autoimmune diagnosis you can make without biopsy, lupus, Sjogren's, very easy just through serology. Then there's other,
viral syndromes, Hep C, HIV, I would definitely send an HIV test. Maybe it's already been sent. It absolutely needs to be sent. But then you're like, could this be lymphoma? And I would have to see if lymphoma can cause these migratory oligoarthritis. In the cases of lymphoma I've seen, I haven't now I'm doing like an illness script matching to the problem representation. I can't really recall like oral ulcers and like these skin findings that you described on the patient's knuckle. But now I'm worried about a diffuse inflammatory / infiltrative syndrome that is, I think the oligomigratory is just immune dysregulation and you're seeing it jump from joint to joint. But beyond lymphoma, Robbie, I don't know what else the splenomegaly and diffuse, like I don't think it's IgG4 disease with the retroperitoneum. I don't think it's solid metastatic cancer. But now I'm just like reflexively thinking. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, no, I think autoimmunity is, I think that ultimately we know the immune system is activated. And before we lazily say the problem is in the immune system, we have to hunt vigorously for an antigen driving it. And I think as a general rule of thumb, whenever there's asymmetry, like there is in this case with the arthritis, there's often an antigen present. I feel like autoimmune diseases are beautifully symmetric, at least when they've been allowed to evolve, you know? And so when you're seeing the little bit of asymmetry, you know, if you have ILD from an autoimmune disease, you're bilateral hyalymphadenopathy, right? For sarcoid, not unilateral. Unilateral makes your jaw drop, right? So I feel like the question is, how much do you invest in the asymmetry that the arthritis affords you? Because the rest of the case is perfectly symmetric, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm on the hunt for the antigen. The question is, what is that antigen? Is it a malignant cell that the body is reacting to, or is it a exogenous infectious process? And I think the infectious process that trigger reticuloendothelial activation that are universally present everywhere, are all the viruses you just said. Basically, there's mono everywhere, there's HIV everywhere. But then there's a subset of infections that trigger the reticuloendothelial system that are epidemiologically restricted. And so in Zavin's part of the world, it's not that far away from my part of the world, but phenomenally varied by infectious, the range of infections is very different. So this might be a perfect example for murine typhus, right? A patient who is in the Houston area who has a syndrome like this. So you think about it. I mean, if this were me, I'd be taking doxy for sure. The downsides of that are very little, but this is where I think, the travel history to Greece becomes a little bit relevant, because you start to say, wait, hold on, what are the infections that are present in Greece? And I don't know, but having grown up in the Mediterranean and around the Mediterranean, I know that TB is not unheard of. But then again, you would expect, wait, hold on, TB, should we look at the lungs? We haven't looked at the lungs. But then whenever you think reticuloendothelial activation and arthritis, my aunt had really bad brucellosis, and I've never forgotten that. So I think, I don't think it's time to pontificate on all the fancy-smancy infections that could be. I think the general principles are there's immune activation, it's asymmetric cancer or an infection. And if you're going to do an infection workup, you really need to know where he has been. And I think you really, should zoom in on Greece. Does it change what you do? Yeah, it gives you some hope that you can diagnose this without a lymph node biopsy. Because if you get a positive, whatever, AFB sputum or positive antibody to something or response to doxy, you may call it that. So I'm calling everybody to get the lymph node analysis done. But the serological workup that I'm doing just broadened based on where this person has been.
Beautiful. And zooming in more on the history of the travel. He was abroad for about a month, visiting family and spending time both in urban and rural areas and sort of doing as the locals do. And that was enough for ID to check several sort of infectious serologies, of which the Brucella melitensis, IgG and IgM, returned positive on day 19, 20 of the illness. and he was started on doxycycline and streptomycin. And of course, there was just tremendous relief among the family and everybody that there was a diagnosis and treatment was started. But for several days, he still wasn't feeling better, still having fevers, not eating a lot, losing weight. His ankle swelled up even after he started the treatment. But that is the diagnosis. This he eventually, on day 4 or 5 of treatment, turned a corner and everything just got better pretty quickly. Everything sort of, all the symptoms went away. He gained a weight back and was doing much better. So the diagnosis was brucellosis, thought to be acquired from eating like unpasteurized dairy products in the home country. Curious what reflections you guys have.
You know, first of all, like, thank you for presenting this case, Alvin. I thought it was incredible. And the way that you presented it, not for a second did I anticipate we would end up where we ended up. Just asking both of you guys, is the... like, what's the classic illness script for Brucella? Is there a classic illness script, or is it one of those organisms that can have such, you know, broad scoping manifestations?
So, yeah, and by the way, just to also reveal, this case was sort of told from the perspective of my dad's friend. And the 19-year-old person was me 20 some years ago.
Oh my god!
Crazy. And yeah, the only sort of changed feature of the case was that it was Armenia, not Greece. But I made sure that the epidemiology was nearly equivalent in the two countries before picking Greece. No, I've been wanting to share this case for a while, just because it was obviously personal and very interesting, and it was a very difficult diagnostic journey for, you know, for everybody. And just had, I had a very classic case. So 80% of patients with brucellosis have a systemic illness characterized by all three of those kind of cardinal symptoms, like the so-called undulating fevers, sort of very stereotyped daily. Migratory oligoarthritis, very much like this, and then night sweats, which again sort of flew under the radar as a symptom because of what I described. I just sort of didn't think anything of it, but in retrospect, they even had the typical sort of musty smell that it was just very, very unusual. And then some of those other sort of peripheral mucocutaneous and like the weight loss and ulcers and the weird subcutaneous nodules, they happen. I don't exactly understand why. But to your point, Reza, it can very much also present as a focal disease. So the most common like focal site of illness, other than the arthritis, which is thought to be both like actual septic arthritis and potentially sort of immunologic reactivity, is the spine. So just like TB, it can cause bone disease, specifically in the spine, and then the liver. You can cause sort of granulomatous hepatitis. Actually, neuropsychiatric symptoms, which in me were also very prominent, are commonly described too. I felt very different from myself. It was very weird, sort of disproportionate to just like, you know, being worried and not feeling well. I just didn't feel like myself. But yeah, it was a very classic case. But the key things are just sort of this fever of unknown origin, migratory arthritis, and then the epidemiologic risk factor, which at the point where like my dad's like ID friend in Armenia heard about the case, he was like, oh, it's Brucella, obviously. And like, you know, then my ID doctor here like sent the serology and, you know, made the diagnosis. So.
No, I feel like for everybody listening, I think this diagnosis is so much more gettable when you have epidemiological exposure, splenomegaly, lymphadenopathy and arthritis. Like honestly, if you just do what I'm learning to do better, which is to use AI to help you solve medicine, this case would be an effortless case if you knew the problem. And for me, Zavin, you're teaching us through your own personal experience. Like I didn't think of Brucella until the moment that I said it. I swear, it didn't even come across my mind. It's because the problem was so hard to study. This whole time, you were sitting there with splenomegaly, lymphadenopathy, Brucella coursing in your body, but it was not apparent at all with how the syndrome presented. And I think, gosh, what a powerful illustration that the real hurdles in medicine are not to solve a problem. Solving this problem, once you crystallize it, I think can be done by after third year of medical school and just with some fundamental AI skills. Determining what to put in ChatGPT or Open Evidence was an incredibly difficult exercise. And the biggest takeaways that I will have on this case is when somebody tells you that something suddenly happened to them, you really want them to take a breath and look back. And if we had done that in this case and it had gone well, you would hear, no, this I've been having night sweats for the last two weeks. Oh, night sweats for the last 2 weeks? The case changes completely, right? And then for me, I think, I know Prof. Rez, your recent CT abdomen pelvis adventures have been non-productive, but when somebody has night sweats, when somebody has night sweats, that CT right there would... rapidly. So thank you for clinical reasoning is all about finding the problem, not finding the answer. Once you find the problem, the answer becomes three clicks away, especially in that era of AI. Yeah. What an awesome hour. Thank you so much.
And Prof. Rez, like, especially that this is where you're like, you type in migratory oligoarthritis and like you're there. So that problem representation was brilliant.
Thank you so much, Zavin. And I feel so lucky to be in this session with the both of you. It's just really incredible. I savor this, and I've really come to care so much about you, and I just appreciate you as a friend.
Oh my God, it's so mutual. Thank you for having me, and like I love having you guys in my ears when I'm jogging or driving around, and this is such a privilege. Thank you.
And Robbie, you're not bad either.
Sign us out, Zavin. Sign us out.
Doo-doo-doo.
That's a wrap, folks.